Murray for Mayor.
Hello, super urbanists. It was great to see Dazeen pick up on our broadcast about David Adjaye. Glad to know that all the best people are listening. Hi, Tom. This is perhaps another of our podcasts which you might be interested in. Today, Peter Murray is our interviewee. He is the founder of the London Festival of Architecture and the influential New London Architecture, a membership organisation for London's built environment. He was also the publisher of Blueprint, the greatest architecture magazine ever made. Anyway, the news is Peter will be standing for London Mayor in the 2028 elections. Amazing. He'll be vying for office against God knows what assortment of ne'er-do-wells and count bin faces. Certainly a broader array than usual of candidates given the fragmentation of our political landscape. As you will hear in this interview, Peter is doing so to make the case that the built environment should be at the heart of policy for the London Mayor. I asked him to give me some historical background to his call for the post of city architect to be established in London, or re-established, and also some wider comparison with the rest of the world. Peter Murray being Peter Murray, he was more than happy to oblige.
I'm Peter Murray, trained as an architect, but spent my working life in curating it, writing about it, and not actually practicing architecture. More recently, I've been the co-founder of New London Architecture, London's architecture centre, and also the founder of the London Festival of Architects.
Peter, one of the areas in what we'd like to talk about is the role of the city architect. And I thought it would be useful if you could give us a bit of historical context for London. I read you referring to Lord Rogers as Ken Livingstone's de facto city architect. Perhaps if you could paint the scene a little bit from your knowledge of the ecology of development and architecture in London, how that relationship emerged and in what way it was useful to the city.
In my terms, it goes back to 1986 when I organised with Dejan Sucic an exhibition at the Royal Academy called New Architecture, the work of Foster Rogers Stirling. And in that, Richard Rogers presented a fascinating scheme focused on better public spaces in London. Centrepiece of it was the pedestrianisation of Trafalgar Square and a park along the Victorian Embankment instead of the motorway that was there at the time. And I can see now that it was the beginnings of a development of Richard Rogers' views of how London should develop in the future, which was then further studied, I would say, in his books about Cities for a Small Planet, his Reith lectures, and also his working with the Labour government then to produce the Urban Task Force in the late 90s. And this was about transport-oriented development, densifying cities, bringing back people to London, because in the post-war era, the era of new towns and a belief amongst planners and politicians that cities were basically too crowded and too polluted and we needed to move people out to new towns in the countryside. After the 1990s, there was a shift. People wanted to come back into the city. Cities were seen once again as exciting places to be. Yet Richard Rogers was very concerned that they would sprawl across the countryside. Now, of course, London has the benefit of the green belt around to stop that. But his plans around the Urban Task Force were looking at how you found the space in cities to densify, to deliver growth in the cities. And we can see now, 25 years later, really, how successful that plan was in terms of having accommodated now some 2 million extra people into the city without great stress. The idea of opportunity areas, developing these probably brownfield sites, areas with good public transport connections so people didn't need the car, reducing the dependency on the car, promoting public transport. And the shape of London has changed with these groupings of often taller buildings. but actually...
So just before we get into that new landscape, you described this exhibition that you did in 1986. Perhaps you could help us describe how London was managed, or indeed not managed, in terms of its plan, in terms of development.
If we go back to, say, before 1986, where cities all around England had city architects, and London had the Greater London Council and their architects department, which was at the time the largest architectural practice in the world. And it was an essential, I might say, breeding ground for good architects. A lot of successful practices in the post-war period. Those architects, they started off their career doing 2 or 3 years at the GLC or the LCC, as it was even before that. They would practice there and often form their partnerships. So really important part of the city. And you can see now there are still many housing schemes delivered by the GLC, built, designed, and provide good housing even today. Then there was this shift, which was partly the fact that actually city architects themselves were getting slightly frustrated in the 1970s because there was so little building going on, and their job was much more about looking after the local authority's estate rather than building new buildings. In those days, an architect saw their job as knocking down a building and building something new. That was what they did. Retrofit was for surveyors, not architects. And so even city architects at the time were becoming a little bit frustrated with their role. When Mrs. Thatcher took over as Prime Minister, the policies were very much about reducing the scale of the public sector. And so we saw this big shift. When the GLC was gotten rid of by Mrs. Thatcher, because it was then actually led by Ken Livingstone, who was very far to the left, and that annoyed Mrs. Thatcher hugely, and probably it was as much her hatred of Ken Livingstone which actually led to the demolition of the GLC. And then the problem was that in that intervening period, there was no real organised guiding light, you might say, for the strategic development of London. There were a lot of private contributions to the debate. A lot of groups got together because in 1986, Margaret Thatcher deregulated the banking system, and that led to a huge growth of activity within the City of London. It really sped up the increase in population in London. So everyone could see this massive change happening. Globalism was speeding up that level of change. And as far as the City of London was concerned, it was right at the centre of it because people realised that trading would finish in Hong Kong just about the time that everyone started trading in London, and then they would hand over to New York at the end of the day. And people started to understand what globalism actually meant, and the city was in the forefront of that, yet there was no real clear policy of how you dealt with that. And so the discussions with Tony Blair, and I think we realised that the shift when the Architecture Foundation organised a large gathering in Westminster, bringing together community groups and those involved in the built environment sector. Blair talked about it, and that was a real moment of change in London, where he announced that the Labour government would deliver an elected mayor for London, which was really what was necessary, and I think Richard Rogers realised was very important. Richard Rogers was then commissioned to carry out the work on the Urban Task Force, and the thinking in the Urban Task Force was then transferred to the new Greater London Authority when it started out in 2000, which was related to Richard Rogers' thinking around the compact city. So fundamentally, it was that all development for London took place within the Greater London area. No sprawl. London needed to become more sustainable.
So just in a practical sense, what was your observations on how Rogers and Livingstone worked together? Because we think of Rogers as a cosmopolitan architect, but yet there was some relationship on a political level between the two. How did that play out in the way they worked together?
Yeah, I think there was a close relationship with the Labour Party. Richard Rogers was definitely to the left anyway, and the Labour Party grandees would dine regularly at the River Cafe, which was Richard Rogers and partners' canteen, and then became a very famous restaurant in its own right. So if you went there, you'd often see the movers and shakers of the Labour Party dining there. And actually, I remember being there with a large group with Richard Rodgers and the most left-wing person here was a chap called Brian Anson, who had stopped the redevelopment of Covent Garden some 10 years earlier and was a pretty rebellious guy. And he was having an argument with Richard during the meal. And to make a point, he picked up a bottle of fizzy water and started banging it on the table to make a point. In which case, of course, the fizzy water became even fizzier and started shooting out like a fountain over all these political figures around the table. And Ruthie came over and made sure that this argument stopped before everyone left the restaurant. It was a place for debate, discussion, and where people got together for those political issues. So yes, he was very engaged. But I think the really interesting thing about Livingstone was that he was also a pragmatist. I think having looked at mayors in the States as well, I think the best mayors are ones who are pragmatists rather than dogmatists. And so Ken Livingstone realised that actually development was key to a number of things that he needed to do in the city. First of all, the mayor of London didn't have very much money to play with. And Ken Livingstone realised that actually development generates a lot of money for good things to be done in the city. So if you take something like the Shard, I think it was around 34 million in Section 106 money that was paid for improvements of London Bridge Station and the area around the Shard. And if that was replicated across London, that's a huge income for the mayor, which can be spent on affordable housing and social improvement. And so he actually worked very closely with the development business, with architects, with Richard Rodgers, obviously, and the Architecture and Urbanism Unit, which was set up with Ricky Burdett, later to become professor at the London School of Economics, really started moving the dial in terms of how London would grow. And at that stage, actually, the growth was seen to be rather less than it turned out. And over the next 20 years, we had to accelerate the provision of new accommodation.
And the Architecture and Urbanism Unit was set up
within the GLA. Richard Rodgers was part-time. He was still running the practice. And there was a team there. Some of the team then moved on later. After Richard Rodgers stopped that role, it moved to the LDA, which was the London Development Authority, which you might say the regional development organisation, which was set up as a part of a network across the country that the Labour government had designated. When we had a regional development strategy, so there was a South East Development Authority, there were ones all around the country. When the Tories came into power in 2010, all those regional authorities then...
They are quangos. They're constituted from development and local authority working together to drive development.
They were quangos and they coordinated investment into growth in those areas and had a strategic planning role as well.
It's a very dynamic landscape that you're describing. All political scenarios, democratic ones, should be dynamic, one might say, but marrying it with stability and expertise is key, I suppose. How would you characterise, and I think it's really one of the hidden stories in where we are politically at the moment, but also where we are in terms of the built environment, that first coalition government and then the Cameron government, what were they thinking? Did they understand that their role in driving development? Did they have a handle on it?
I think from an architectural point of view, the thing that characterises that moment most is the sudden demolition of the Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment, which just went overnight. There was a change in the budgets and it was cut. And Ed Vasey, who was Minister of Culture at the time, even he was taken by surprise that it suddenly went. And it wasn't a real policy, it was just an easy one to cut.
The bonfire of the quangos, as it was.
That's right. And that I think that took away all credibility the government had in terms of really having any sincerity about delivering better environment, because CABE had done really important work, I think, in standards, placemaking, architectural quality generally. But I think I've always believed that Britain should have proper regional plans. I think it's only sensible, yet they were gotten rid of pretty fast. And I remember seeing a letter that Eric Pickles, who was minister at the time, writing to City Hall in London, saying that the word regional should not appear anywhere in the London plan, that regional planning was not something that they thought was helpful, and that there was a duty for different authorities to work together, but not that there should be this idea of some wider vision of, in our case, the southeast, which is, I think, from a planning point of view, patently ridiculous, really. When you think of how London sits in the southeast and how much of the economy of the southeast is focused on London, housing a lot of the people who work in London, is the role of boroughs outside the Greater London Authority. It seems crazy that there isn't some greater coordination of the whole area. But that was a big change. And I would say, from a London point of view, it was also a shift with Boris Johnson having taken over as mayor. And so what has happened ever since Boris Johnson, the role of design with City Hall has dropped tier by tier to become now a very worthy but relatively minor role within City Hall policy, despite the appointment by Sadiq Khan, the design advocates, and also during Boris's role, there was the mayor of London's design advisory group, and did quite a lot of interesting things. It actually wrote a report, which it left on the desk when Boris left, about good growth, which was a policy which then Sadiq Khan actually took on, called it the same thing when there was a change of administration. A committee is not the same as having a leader in the role who has the ear of the mayor. The design advocates do good work, but actually they are much lower down the food chain than I think they should be.
Was it your experience in the design advisory group that led you to start thinking about the role of the city architect again?
I think it was very much thinking about Richard Rogers and the impact that he has had on London over 40 years, really, and changing the shape of London, accent on public space, accent on specification, public transport. I think all listening to him talk many times made me think, we don't have anyone with this vision at the top table anymore. And what do we do about it? And to a certain extent, I don't hark back to post-war days, because that was very different. They were driving a rehousing the country, and they built a lot of homes. They had big departments.
Can't a city architect be ignored as easily as a design advisory group if a mayor is so inclined?
I think that is a good point, but I think mayors who ignore the built environment and the quality of the built environment do so at their peril. And I would say also that the idea of having design champions is something which is cross-party, because there was a report produced by the Conservative government called Build Beautiful, Build Better. And within that, there was a paragraph which said, we need somebody to lead. And I think they might have called them placemaker or something like that. But in my terms, that is actually just avoiding the issue. And I think that architects with a bit of an urban design background have the right vision. That was the vision that Richard Rogers had. And it's a vision that I think not all architects, but lots of architects, I can think of a lot of architects who one could appoint to that role, who have that ability to take this holistic view of bringing together all the complex strands of urbanism to create better places.
I realise that it's dominating your thinking and or of places outside the UK, because you've just come from it. But when we spoke last time, you mentioned a few cities that you've been to.
I did go and look at other cities where change had been happening and who was driving that change. So I went to Pristina, capital of Kosovo, still rebuilding after the Balkan War, and rebuilding socially and physically. And so I met there with the Mayor Rama, who I watched on Facebook, and he'd be going around the city pointing at buildings, walking through streets, shaking hands with building workers. I couldn't understand what he was saying because he was speaking in his own language. He was clearly really embedded in the physical change. And then it turns out that he's an architect. Actually, as a part of the diaspora during the war, he had come to London. He'd worked as an architect in London for 14 years and then taken all those skills back to the city and was leading major change, improvement in placemaking, transport issues, safer streets, all sorts of things which are current in cities now around the world. And I thought, that is a mayor and an architect is one person, which is not always possible, because actually architects don't get very involved in politics at all, really, which I always find surprising. And then another city is Medellin in Colombia, which has gone through probably the greatest change of almost any city in the world. In 1996, it was deemed to be the most dangerous city in the world, and Pablo Escobar had been controlling large chunks of it for a long time. And after he was then killed, there was a possibility of change. And it's a city where a lot of informal settlements going up these steep hills either side of the main river running through the centre of the city, which has all got a motorway which cut the city in half. And a couple of mayors then were appointed who had a really clear idea about both architecture itself, but also how that was associated with city planning and also giving people some hope that the city could see better days. Infrastructure and housing became central to the way they improved the city. They put in cable cars, which were perfect for the very mountainous topography of the city. It also gave those people living in those informal settlements access into the centre. And of course, you didn't have to demolish huge numbers of houses to actually put in a new transport system. That was connected into a metro system, and they have a great philosophy there of talking about it, my city, my metro, my river, my park, these things where people have real ownership and really look after their own city, which is really important. And a key move, though, was using architecture really as a symbol for this change. So in those very poor communities, they would build libraries and schools, which might bring hope to those neighbourhoods, but there were mayors who really had an understanding of what architecture and planning can do to turn a place around. And so I think those cities that have been through a lot of stress certainly have these really focused, let's say, building-oriented mayors. Now, we maybe don't have that level of stress. We have mayoral policies about equitable cities. And it seems to me, what can be less equitable than having nowhere to live? And, you know, we've got 163,000 people living in temporary accommodation at the moment. Actually, putting up buildings is actually a really significant part of the role of a mayor, and having a chief architect to deliver that, I think, is really important.
Let's talk about the meeting now that you had in Copenhagen. How did it develop your thinking on the subject?
Somebody tipped me off that there was going to be a conference of city architects in Copenhagen organised by the Danish government, who are currently the presidents of the EU and have a whole cultural programme which they're delivering, and this was part of it. So I wrote to them and said, could I come as an observer? And they were very welcoming and said yes. And so I did. And one of the days was meeting up with city architects from Copenhagen, obviously from Stockholm, where they've had a city architect since 1661, Gdansk, Warsaw, all sorts of really fascinating places. And there was a day-long discussion of what city architects do, but also what they could do and should be doing. And it was just really encouraging. It was very clear that these people are at the top table. And I think that is so important. Each city seemed to operate slightly differently. And I think everyone agreed that different cities require different treatment depending on the political setup, the characterization of the city. They all have slightly different ways of working. But I think that fact that they are at a senior level within decision-making in the city is really important.
Going back to the earlier part of your conversation, your description of the relationship between Ken Livingstone and Richard Rogers, and comparing it to now, and thinking about, well, maybe that was a unique moment when there was an understanding of the spatial implications of policy. And that seems to be one of the most valuable aspects of the city architect. It's not so much the propositional, although that is very useful. It's also the reminder that anything you propose plays itself out in that built environment.
No, I think that the successful mayors are ones that do realise the impact that physical change has on the quality of people's lives, which for people from a design and building background seems strange that people don't really understand that, whether it's mould on children's bedrooms or just actually having permanent shelter over your head. And I think that there is a lot more that can be done by engaging better with the built environment sector, as Ken Livingstone did, to improve what is happening in London. And I would say, you know, there are political issues here in that there is a section of, I'd say, the left who believe that almost property is theft and that all developers are just out to make profit. And we did some research at NLA not long ago about what are the issues that the built environment sector needs to address. And one of those is trust, that actually there is a lot of miscommunication that goes on about development. There are clearly some developers who are fairly unscrupulous, but I would say there are an awful lot of people I deal with on a regular basis who are really seriously trying to do the best for the city and best for its citizens.
If you could wave a magic wand, would you just say London's got to have a city architect? He's got to have a department of how many people? Like 50 or something like that.
I think it's too soon to say how big that department might be, because different cities have very different sizes of department. In Sydney, I think they've got about 200 people, very successful. Again, their city architect working very closely with city mayor. Have done a lot of good things. But I would think actually it needs to be a fairly small team who really work, rather like Design for London did, coming up with lots of ideas, but then it's the private sector, which is obviously built up in the absence of as people were moved out of the public sector. That private sector is now very active, very creative, a lot of good people, and I think you engage with them. That being said, I do think that we need to get back into a situation where more local authorities are delivering more public housing, particularly social housing. So I would see the public sector becoming more active actually than it is at the moment in delivering physical change. So from my point of view, I'm working politically at trying to shift it. The RIBA have been very supportive in the idea of they'd like to see city architects right across the country. I'm really focusing on London. So that's why I'm planning to stand for election as Mayor of London in 2028.
Wow. Is this the first time you're announcing your candidacy? Have you announced it before?
I've spoken to a lot of people about it just to check whether it was total lunacy or not. And I get very positive response from people within our sector. And I do think, at the least, you can change the debate that goes on. We're looking at a very different election, probably, in the next one, because instead of just having two candidates, Conservative and Labour, way ahead of everybody else, there's now going to be six parties probably vying. So it's a very different debate. There'll be lots of people who haven't had, I might say, the experience of governing London. And if they get elected in, I would hope that the support that I can get can actually shift the dial, really, of the way things are done. And city architects will be part of that. But I think all the other aspects about what I've learned from studying cities around the world, I can get engaged with the people who take over City Hall next time around, whoever that might be. And I would say my thinking about that goes back some time to the election before last, when I spoke a lot to not just Sadiq Khan Khan, but the other people standing for election. And I was, might say, appalled by their ignorance of what this sector delivers.
In what way? Just the lack of knowledge or their just dismissal of it?
I think their lack of knowledge of how housing is delivered, how affordable housing delivered, what levels of affordable you need to have, how do you deliver more housing within the public sector. I was 6 years on the board of BeFirst at Barking and Dagenham. Very enlightened leadership, and that became number one in terms of delivery of public housing in the country in 3 to 4 years. That sort of change can happen, but you need to understand the structure of the built environment sector and how it's delivered. And I found a really depressing level of understanding.
We didn't even touch on the exceptionalism that the Conservatives used for a development, the Canary Wharf condition, where you remove planning conditions and supercharge things, but then you need some form of bureaucratic control. So we have these constantly evolving and collapsing bureaucracies of development, which move largely around the east of London, people coming and going. And it does seem that churn, though it creates a sense of dynamism and urgency and flexibility, there is a lot of wastage in that, just in terms of human expertise, to which the city architect, although it pertains to a single figure, that figure coalescing a group of professionals which both operate within government but also in a kind of penumbra around it, it does give a sense of retention of knowledge, retention of expertise in a landscape that really does urgently require that.
I think one needs to look at those places that have worked and what lessons we can gain from that. And I think that BeFirst was a very interesting lesson. It's not been able to avoid some of the other problems that have hit, particularly the housing sector, of increased interest rates, increased building costs, all that side of things. But the planning department there is really good in that it is a doing rather than a stopping planning department. And I think another place to look is the City of London, which is really interesting in the way that it is delivering what it needs to do based on the likely figures of growth within the city, so that they are ready for a surprising amount of growth. There was a time not long ago after Brexit when everyone thought all the banks and everyone's going to shift out of London, they're all going to Frankfurt and Paris. They're still here. They're looking for space, and you have to know what is needed to deliver it. And I had a round table with Peter Rees and not long ago talking about city architects, and he said I was the nearest thing to a city architect when I was at the City of London, and he did to a certain extent play that role. But also it generated, and with there was also a chap called Michael Cassidy, who was key to the way that the city developed, as chairman of the Policy and Resources Committee there, to this idea that you have this proactive planning system where you know what you need, you engage with the private sector to deliver it, and you then have an attitude to welcoming development that is necessary, and actually being quite clear about stuff they don't need. I think wrongly, actually, they don't feel they need more residential in the city, and they're very clear that's not top of their agenda at all. It's a very interesting example to follow and for other people to look at.
So when you say proactive planning, you're talking about research into the numbers of new units that are needed, looking through the physical environment of the particular area and considering and proposing different spaces for those to go. Is that kind of the thing you're talking about?
Yes. The idea of strategic plans is that you have an idea how your population is going to change, probably here it's going to grow, what skills you're going to need, whereabouts they can be located. That is what planners who do local plans, strategic plans, they sort out that bit. What we need is then the vision that goes on top of that. Once you know what you need, then you have to find strategies to deliver those in the numbers that you need them. One of the resilient aspects of London, you would say it's a bit of a muddle, but actually London is the way planning works and so on, we're actually pretty flexible in how we do it, say compared to Paris. We have a common law system which allows that debate and argument about, whereas in Paris they set a master plan and it can't be changed for 20-25 years. Here we adapt to circumstance and growth has changed. There was a huge uplift in the projections for housing needs after the 2011 census. Suddenly realised actually London was growing much faster than we thought. Then everyone got a bit worried of Brexit. Now, what's that going to do to population? Right at the moment, it still looks we're going up to past the 10 million mark by the 2030s. Demographics is, these days is quite tricky because also a lot of political stuff going on around that. London, hopefully, will... It's resisted the negative aspects of immigration so far. We have a high percent of people of non-British birth in London operating quite happily as Londoners and engaging in the city and making a vital contribution to the wealth, not just of London, but of the rest of the country. Murray for Mayor.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Peter. That's absolutely fascinating, both as a history and also casting forward to the future. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Murray for Mayor. Amazing. Amazing. I don't agree with Peter Murray about everything. I think, for example, if we were to discuss regional development agencies, we could have a good old disagreement about that. I think there's a book to be written about the way they obfuscate a lack of industrial policy and play a role in frustrating local democracy for a decade. Anyway, let's not ruin a sense of consensus. That's a side issue. I think he's right about city architects. Although I think it's very telling that his rationale as to why the post withered away was because architects didn't fancy it as much as Thatcher got rid of them. They didn't want to be custodians of existing buildings and wanted to build new stuff, so it went private and the post kind of stopped. Now architecture is generally a profession that sees itself as custodians rather than the creators of the built environment. And so the job has a real appeal to it, and I think it does actually reflect how architects see their role in society and how they can be of use. Like all other arts, there are cycles to architecture. They just operate in cycles of centuries rather than decades. Obviously, the Mayor cycle is a little less short. Murray for Mayor, 2028 will come quickly, my friends. Next up, I think we will be having the review of the year. So if you have any ideas of your favourite architectural moments, do send them to me at mail@timabrahams.net. mail@timabrahams.net or Twitter's timabrahams or machine_books. Anyway, like, subscribe, share, like, subscribe, share. Talk to you soon, 2025, and we're still alive.